It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in the second part of our program, we'll focus on RagBri, which begins this week, that great bike ride across Iowa that's been going since the early 1970s. We'll be joined by NPR's Don Gagne of the team NPR, but it stands for No Pie Refused. Also, Kyle Munson, a columnist for the Des Moines Register, will join us. But first, people are being bought, sold, and smuggled like modern-day slaves. And it's not in some faraway country. It's right here in Iowa in the present day. My first guest is Ambassador-at-Large Louis C. DeBaca. He has worked under three presidential administrations to combat human trafficking and modern forms of slavery. Since 2009, when he was appointed by President Obama, C. DeBaca has served in the State Department in the Office to Monitor and Combat Trafficking in Persons. Prior to that, he was one of the most decorated federal prosecutors in the Justice Department, leading the investigation and prosecution of cases involving money laundering, organized crime, official misconduct, hate crimes, as well as human trafficking. He earned his undergraduate degree at Iowa State University, is also a native of Iowa, a native of Huxley, Iowa. Ambassador C. DeBaca, welcome back to our program.
It's good to be here, Ben.
According to data from the National Human Trafficking Resource Center, there's been a steady increase in calls reporting human trafficking in Iowa. Why?
I think that some of it is actually the increase in awareness of the problem of human trafficking. I was meeting earlier this week with some folks from the Human Trafficking Task Force that's been pulled together by Attorney General Tom Miller's office. And I think that there's a recognition, especially on the part of the state police and others, that this is a problem that's been going on here in Iowa and in the Midwest for quite a while. But now we finally have the tools to understand what we're actually seeing. And I think that that change in how we're viewing these vulnerable populations, whether it's people that are in prostitution or illegal aliens or others, has the potential that they might be victims of crime. I think that that's what's changing things. And unfortunately, it makes you wonder how many of these cases were here all along and we were just missing them.
Yeah, so it's not necessarily an increase in the cases of human trafficking. You're saying it could be just an increase in our awareness and through the reporting.
Well, and thank God, because I think that that, you know, allows us to do what I think as Iowans, all of us would like to think, which is that if we saw something bad happening to someone else, that we would rush to help out. And I think that that case that we saw earlier in the year reported in the New York Times and otherwise about the gentlemen who were on the turkey farm in Altalissa, you know, for years people had seen these men mentally handicapped, mentally retarded, who were being forced and kept in squalid conditions, barely paid at all, sometimes used force and violence against. And folks in that town certainly had compassion towards those gentlemen, but they didn't really realize that there were modern slaves just there in their midst.
Mm-hmm. So maybe it is a good time to just give us the parameters of what we're talking about so that we know what may be happening on a farm, as in that case you just mentioned. But so this is labor and sex trafficking we're looking at, right?
Well, just to review, the way that the United States government looks at human trafficking is that it's an umbrella term that describes all of the activities involved in reducing someone to or holding them in a condition of compelled service. In other words, it's modern slavery. It could be an adult, it could be a child, it could be a foreigner or an American, man, woman, and it could be for sex or it could be for labor. So we're really looking at a kind of a multifaceted crime, but that shares the biggest thing, which is that someone's freedom is being taken away from them. And I think that that's, again, something that, you know, thinking about Iowa values and fairness, I think it's something that really shocks our conscience. And it's something that Iowans have been fighting against, certainly since the time of the Civil War.
We mentioned an uptick in the reporting of human trafficking in Iowa. Is that a trend unique to Iowa or other states seeing similar upticks in reporting?
We are seeing similar upticks in reporting across the country. And, you know, right now we've got 55 of the 57 states and territories have passed modern anti-trafficking legislation in the last 10 years, focusing on this notion of victimization, of enslavement. Some of the best state laws that are out there also look at victim protection. And that's one of the things that we saw in this last legislative session. And a real I think coming together on the part of the folks in the Iowa legislature across party lines to pass good legislation that sought to approach these victims as victims and survivors rather than looking at perhaps the fact that they had committed a crime when they were being held in servitude. Perfect example of that is the Iowa Safe Harbor Law, which will allow prosecutors now to have an option other than charging somebody for prostitution if it looks as though that person was being held against their will. And even for people to go to the courts and explain their situations and have the judge be able to wipe the record clean, an expungement of their criminal history. Mm-hmm. And so what we're looking at from the State Department perspective is to take this attitude that's sweeping the United States, that Iowa and other Midwestern states are showing a lot of leadership on, and then taking that around the world to the 190 or so countries in the UN system, and really encouraging them to do the same thing, to focus on prevention, on protection, and prosecution of trafficking cases.
Mm-hmm. You're referring to a law that Governor Branstad signed in April, I believe, against child pornography, human trafficking. And I'm wondering, does that go far enough? Does this put Iowa perhaps at the forefront in terms of law?
Well, I think that we, as we look at the United States situation every year in the annual Trafficking in Persons report put out by the State Department, we see a country that is doing well compared to a number of countries around the world, but you know, there's about 21 million people who are enslaved worldwide, according to the International Labor Organization, and only around 45,000 victims discovered and helped every year globally. So we've got a long way to go, but it's this kind of innovation that we saw out of the Iowa legislature, and with this bill, I think that hopefully will create a race to the top among the different states.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit more, Ambassador Sidibaka, about who these children are. Our listeners are wondering, specifically for children, are they Iowans? Do they come from outside the state? Are they coming from outside the country?
Well, one of the things that was very inspiring on this trip home for me is yesterday I was giving a speech up at Story County in Nevada, kicking off the Story County Fair, a speech that frankly, I had attended as a young 4-H'er, seeing people like Rosie Greer and others who'd been brought into Central Iowa to give inspirational messages to 4-H youth. And I was lucky enough to be able to give that presentation last night. And I was introduced by a young lady who had, at the age of 14, been lured into trafficking by a pimp that found her when she'd run away from home. She was, I think, in Cedar Falls. And found her at a Hy-Vee and started telling her how pretty she was and why didn't she come with him and that she could be a model and all these things. And she suddenly ends up in Chicago in a prostitution situation. Mm-hmm. She's now 22. She's going to Des Moines Area Community College. She's working with youth that are at risk through youth and shelter services up in Ames. And she's trying to prevent this from happening to anybody else, what happened to her. But she's a kid from Central Iowa who none of us would look twice at on the street if we walked by. She's just somebody who we would expect to see in our high schools, in our hometowns. And that's really the face of human trafficking. There's a perception that this is going to be somebody from the city or this is going to be somebody from another country. And those risks and those vulnerabilities certainly exist. But those risks and vulnerabilities also exist for kind of stereotypical Iowa kids.
Uh-huh. So how do we raise our awareness when we seem to be, have been oblivious to human trafficking, perhaps going on in our communities? How can we identify it? Are there signs to look for? And what do we do if our antenna are alerted?
Well, I think that one of the things that for folks to remember is if there's a suspicion that there's a human trafficking situation, we can always call the National Human Trafficking Resource Center, which is 1-888-3737-888. And I think that they had been telling us recently that there had been around 59 or 60 calls from Iowa, many of them in forced prostitution allegations, but I think almost 20 were around the issues of forced labor. And so if people see something that doesn't ring true, if you see a man who's escorting two or three different women and checking in and out of rural hotels, if you see women who are being cycled through some of the small town strip clubs here in Iowa. If you see, whether it's migrant workers or other farm workers who are being kept kind of off to the side or show up occasionally, but nobody really knows where they live. Those are things that I think are worth calling into the national hotline.
Quickly, before we have to go, I want to ask you about the border crisis, which we've talked a lot about in this program and has been consuming a lot of headlines. Tens of thousands of unaccompanied minors coming to the U.S., over 50,000 since last October. And we've been talking about on this program the fact that in December of 2008, in the final weeks of the Bush presidency, a law was signed, the William Wilberforce Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization Act of 2008. What does that law have to do with this current crisis? Was it an unintended consequence that we now have this flood of unaccompanied minors?
Well, that law has been in effect now for more than 5 years, and we only saw the flood of unaccompanied minors really in the last few months. And I think it's pretty well documented as far as some of the push factors, the destabilization in Central America, the fear that families have of the drug gangs and otherwise, and some misinformation that has gotten out as far as the various programs. But I don't think that it's necessarily the Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization that is driving all of this. Now, what's interesting to note about that reauthorization is that was something that went through Congress with unanimous agreement that it makes perfect sense to focus on what is the best interest of the children. Taking the time to make sure that you see whether or not the child has a refugee claim or an asylum claim or might have been a trafficking victim. Do they have parents who can help take care of them, or do they need to go back to the country of origin so that the family back there can take care of them? So that notion of the best interest of the child determination and how we approach these children compassionately while at the same time complying with our immigration laws was, I think, in the 2008 reauthorization, something that folks on both sides of the aisle could agree upon. And I think that type of compassion is exactly what we're hoping to be able to continue to apply to these children that we find today and down at the border.
Okay, Ambassador Louis C. DeBaca, it's been a real pleasure to speak with you. You work in the State Department in the Office to Monitor and Combat Trafficking in Persons, and happen to be in Iowa today. We're glad you could make time for us again, and I think you're getting in touch with your family roots here in Iowa, and also the 4-H you mentioned, huh?
Well, it was great to be with the folks that are kicking off the fair, and it made me want to put on a seed corn cap and go walk around some steers.
All right, Ambassador. Thanks again for coming into our studio.
Thanks, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, let's continue with a different aspect of this theme. As I mentioned, since October, more than 50,000 children have crossed the U.S.-Mexican border, many of them being detained along our southern border. Most of these children, unaccompanied, are from Honduras, El Salvador, or Guatemala in Central America. Davenport Mayor Bill Gluba has been working to bring some of those children fleeing violence in Central America to the Quad Cities. Mayor Gluba joins me now. Welcome, Mayor.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. You've been working to create a place for a handful of these children in Davenport. Why?
Well, I think it's the humanitarian thing to do. You know, this is a moral issue, a moral crisis. When you have small children, many of them toddlers, being temporarily now or left in, essentially in cages in glorified dog pens in many cases along the Texas border. And that's not America. That's not the way we treat people in need. You know, I go back to the parable of the Good Samaritan. You know, that's appropriate. That's the right thing to do, to treat people the way you would want to be treated. What if it was your grandchildren, my grandchildren, fleeing a persecuted situation? You want people to welcome them with, you know, warmly and open hands and hearts. And I think people in Iowa and Davenport feel that way.
Mayor Gluba, how would that work? I assume you'd be working with customs officials. These children are in a process of seeking asylum, I think, right?
That's right. The question is, legally, are they immigrants or are they refugees? I think they're refugees, and that's still up for grabs. And once you cross the American border and get in the United States, you're entitled to due process under the law. And the law in 2008 said these kids, or any of them coming from those countries that you just mentioned, have to be processed technically, legally, and go through, have a right to appeal and explain their case. And what we've been asked to do, sort of a call by Health and Human Services, is to try to help find sites and locations more appropriate for children, these children, on a temporary basis, from anywhere from probably 35 to 45 days, during which time the Health and Human Service and social workers would try to find if their parents in the country or relatives in the country, or maybe even place them with foster homes temporarily until their cases can be adjudicated. And that's what we're trying to do. And there are lots of specifics, but I'm sure they just don't have it quite all figured out. They got a crisis on their border.
So if I understand you correctly, you contacted the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services?
Well, I contacted the White House. The White House staff put me in touch with Health and Human Services. They got a hold of me and said, sure, we'd be glad if you could provide us some potential sites. Gave us a set of guidelines, general guidelines, and we're now trying to find sites. Mm-hmm. At the time, I said, Iowa, under former Governor Bob Ray, who I served with, I was in the legislature. He's a very decent human being, very open and receptive, and quite frankly, the old type Republicans, the grandfather's type, not what we have today. Anyway, he welcomed Vietnamese refugees into Iowa. He's one of the few governors that did. And they're some of our greatest citizens, the proudest citizens. Their kids, many of them went on to become valedictorian. One was at high school. And they're great citizens. We have, 1,000 or so Vietnamese living in Davenport today, and they're wonderful people. But that was a different era. Bob Ray was a leader, and I credit him with, taking that courageous stand back then.
Mm-hmm. You're talking, I'm sure, also about the statement of our governor, Terry Branstad, says while he feels compassion for these children, he doesn't think they belong in Iowa. They shouldn't be coming to Iowa. So how does that work if the Department of Human, U.S. Department, the federal government, is coordinating with you as a mayor of Davenport, but the Iowa governor says they're not welcome? Doesn't the Iowa governor have the say here?
No. Not at all. I'm sorry. Anybody can come into this country in any city, state that they choose under our federal laws. So the governor, I think he probably just hasn't studied the issue enough, and we all make comments that off the cuff that we shouldn't. And he finally came around and said, well, he's not involved in the Davenport area situation. And so I think if Terry thinks it through a little more and maybe talks to Bob Ray, who he served as lieutenant governor when Bob Ray was governor, that maybe Terry will come around.
Have you had the contact with governor?
No, I haven't. Maybe he will later. I don't know.
What is the feeling like in your community there in the Quad Cities, Mayor Gluba? I imagine there are people on both sides of this issue have been contacting you?
Absolutely. I knew this was not going to be a popular issue. I mean, people got mixed feelings. I mean, depending on who you talk to, some are very vehemently against it. I won't get into all. One of the aldermen said he'd throw himself and stand in front of the buses like they did down in, that place in California if they even suggest, even if they came. But, most people I talk to, or at least enough of them, have got compassion, concern, and really do are Christian or Judeo-Christian, and they're opening and welcoming. Davenport, I pride our city is very diverse. 67 dialects are spoken in Davenport school system. People come here from all over the world because a lot of them have come in with Deere and Company and Galco, et cetera. We're a very global city, and they're a caring city, and I think that's what most good people of goodwill feel, and I want to I'm glad to take that image on as a caring city that's concerned about people irregardless. I mean, that's the American way, that's the Christian way to do it, and I think that's what Iowans really believe deep down inside, at least enough of them, or most of them.
Davenport Mayor Bill Gluba, thank you for the conversation.
Thank you.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. After that interview with Davenport Mayor Gluba earlier today, we contacted the governor's office to make sure we understood the reasoning behind the governor's position here, and we're supplied with this statement. Governor Branstad empathizes with the children and their parents who are seeking a better life in America, but he believes we must secure our border first and follow immigration laws already in place. The governor is concerned that the situation at the border, if not handled properly, may encourage others to attempt the very dangerous journey across Central America and Mexico. That's the end of the governor's statement. Well, we have an entire half of the show yet to come. Joining me right now, Charity Nebbe, to talk about Monday on our program. We have this Monday series going, Ripple Effects. Charity, hi.
Hello, Ben. And we're halfway through the series now on both Talk of Iowa and River to River. But I'm really excited about Monday's shows because on Talk of Iowa, we're going to focus on water quality for the hour. And then on River to River, an hour on air quality.
Right. Water quality, I know, very near and dear to your heart, too. What aspects of water quality are you going to be looking at?
Well, we're going to start at the very beginning, as they say. Okay. So we're going to talk about what a watershed is and how we are all so interconnected here in the state of Iowa. We'll talk about water quality in Iowa over time since we've been monitoring it. How have things changed? We'll talk about some of the big problems that we're facing. And we'll also talk about solutions, and that's the part of the show that I'm most excited about. We're going to talk with Dick Sloan, who is a farmer near Brandon, Iowa, and he's part of the Performance-Based Watershed Management Project. So he voluntarily monitors water quality on his farm. I'll talk with him. He's also working with other farmers to try to get them involved. It's going to be a really fascinating hour, I think.
Sounds like it. And then at noon on Monday, we'll be following that up. I won't be in the host chair. Actually, my colleague Emily Woodbury will be hosting. I'll be off on Ragbri, which we're going to talk about here in a few minutes, Charity. But then we'll talk about air quality. What's in our air here in Iowa? How are we doing as far as air quality? And how our urban air compares to our rural air, for example, Charity. Also, we'll examine muscatine. Muscatine, we've discussed in earlier shows, some of the worst air quality in our state, causing many health problems for some residents of Muscatine. So the combination of air quality and water quality coming Monday on the program. Thanks, Charity.
Well, thank you very much, Ben.
Coming up in the second half of the program, as I said, we're going to focus on Ragbri. It kicks off this Sunday with the first ride. Joining me in just a few moments, Des Moines Register columnist Kyle Munson. Also, NPR's Don Gagne will be joining us. He's of that team that was initiated last year. It goes by the acronym NPR, but it stands for No Pie Refused. Kyle Munson and Don Gagne coming up in just a moment, along with a weather forecast for Ragbri Week. That's when River to River continues. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.